Okay, so let us continue with the famous Kalama Sutta, which is actually not even called the Kalama Sutta, it's actually called the Kesaputya Sutta, but never mind, that's what it's known as. And we have been looking at the qualities of the Buddha, and as I mentioned yesterday, it's a very useful contemplation to contemplate some of these qualities of the Buddha, because it is one of those basic things that we can do on the Buddhist path to give rise to a sense of joy and meaning and inspiration in what is possible to achieve on this path, and what the Buddha also, the qualities of the Buddha himself. So it's good. In this way, in a sense, you make a personal connection, if you like, with the Buddha, and it's almost like you're having a personal connection with the root teacher of the entire Buddhist tradition. And that's very useful, obviously, here, because it draws you into Buddhism. You feel like you are kind of, you have this, everything becomes more meaningful and more clear to you once you have that personal connection, in a sense. So we have been looking at these qualities, and we were saying yesterday the Buddha is like the unsurpassed leader of tameable people, and they're coming towards the end of these qualities here. The next one is that he is the teacher of devas and humans. And the idea of devas in Buddhism is the idea of beings that are beyond the human realm, yeah, beings that are often translated as gods, but not really gods in the kind of Christian sense of the word, but gods in as beings that are at a higher level, of, if you like, of existence. Yeah, so they are beings just like us, except that they are a bit more powerful, a bit more happy, and all of these kind of things. And in ancient India, just like in much of the ancient world, they had this idea of gods, various types of gods that often interfere in human existence. Yeah, in India, they had a large pantheon of gods. And if you go to India today, you see the Hindu temples, they are all decorated with a vast amount of gods. And this is the Hindu tradition, has always been a bit like that, and it goes back, you know, into the mist of time, so to speak. And the point here, that, you know, the reason why this is there is precisely to point out that just because you are a god, even if these gods exist, and according to Buddhism they do exist, yeah, they're just like us in many ways, the Buddha's insight goes beyond that. Yeah, so in a sense, they are kind of putting the Buddha above the ordinary society, the ordinary gods, the ordinary, all of these things. The Buddha kind of goes beyond that. And this is kind of the point of this. Very often when people, you know, have a vision of a god or something like that, it becomes very significant in their life. Oh, I've seen this kind of vision, I've seen something. But very often we just don't know what, even if it is true, even if you do have a vision of a god and you see something like that, what does it actually mean? Yeah, it may seem very splendid, it may seem very marvelous, but just because someone has been born in a high position doesn't necessarily mean they have any wisdom, and that is the problem. Often you find in Buddhism, you find monks or even lay people who kind of channel the knowledge of gods, yeah, they have direct contact with some kind of Brahma or something like that. And everybody is very impressed. Yeah, I got these teachings from the gods, and it's very easy to be impressed by these kind of statements. But the reality is that there's no more certainty in those teachings you get from the gods than any other teachings you get anywhere else. The best teachings that we have available right now, as far as the Buddha is concerned, are probably the ancient legacy that comes in the suttas. But it's very easy to be led astray by all these splendid visions and all these things. And you see that in the suttas as well. You see people getting converted because they see have these kind of visions, and that becomes kind of their mainstay. So, but really, in Buddhism, it is the insight, the wisdom of the Buddha, which is special. And this is why you have this idea of being teacher of gods and humans. And then he is the awakened one, he is the blessed one, the Bhagava. Bhagava is a word that is used in India for spiritual teachers, for gods, and all of these kind of beings. So what does all of this, what does it mean about the Buddha? What does all this actually, what does it amount to? And one of the things that it amounts to, when you see that list there, you see that there is very little there that is actually supernatural. It is all about the insight of the Buddha. It is all about the compassion of the Buddha, his ability to be your teacher, his understanding of reality, this is what it really is about. Yeah, his ability to point out the direction where happiness is found, where suffering is found, and leading you on the path towards that happiness. This is what it is about. There's nothing here about flying through the air, yeah, or sinking into the earth, or reading minds. Is that disappointing, or is it what? I don't know. What do you think? Well, we want to see something more exciting than just this. We want to see kind of. But remember, that is like a side show. It doesn't really matter. Okay, could the Buddha fly through the air? He probably could, but it's kind of irrelevant, isn't it? If you see somebody flying through the air, what does it mean? It means it's a bit of entertainment. Yeah, that's what it means. Yeah, and it's nice to be entertained sometimes, but the problem is that in Buddhism, very often it kind of comes down to the entertainment value. And very often in Buddhist circles, people will talk precisely about these kind of things. Yeah, about people having all kind of spiritual powers and doing kind of marvelous things. And this is kind of what it comes down to. But actually, it turns out to be irrelevant. Because all it is kind of a display of something, a display of a powerful mind, a display of a mind developed or whatever. And if you have faith in Buddhism, you might say, wow, look at that, that's really cool. Look at what these kind of these monks and this Buddha can do. But if you have no faith, you say, it's just a magic trick. Yeah, this is just like one of these magicians doing magical things, and it doesn't actually get you anywhere. And very interestingly, in one of the suttas in the Digha Nikaya called the Kevada Sutta, Digha Nikaya number 11, the Buddha uses very strong words against these supernormal powers. He says, I detest these supernormal powers. I detest them. Yeah, he used the word jagucha. In Pali, jagucha means like, it means literally detest. Yeah, it's a very strong word. And again, why does it do that? Because actually, that's not what the Dhamma is about. It's a side issue, and an issue that often leads you astray, and an issue that people find very fascinating without there really being any good reasons for being fascinated by it. So there's nothing here, yeah, when we recall the Buddha, nothing about supernormal powers, all about down-to-earth things, all about boring stuff, but actually it's not boring at all, because this is where the true happiness lies. This is where you can develop your mind. This is what will give a revolution to your inner life, yeah? This is where the real deal, this is what it's all about. So remember that. This is what will have an effect on you as a person. And this already, I think, is very interesting about this particular list. So you can imagine meeting the Buddha. When you meet the Buddha, because there's nothing here about supernormal powers, what is it that you're going to see? If you go into back to ancient India, you go into the forest, yeah, and you see the Buddha in the forest, what would you see here? And what you would see is pretty much an ordinary person, yeah? You would see someone sitting at the root of a tree, obviously very peacefully, yeah? Sitting there at the root of a tree, looking like an ordinary monk. The Buddha looked very much like a monk. He would have a shaven head. He would wear robes. There wouldn't be any way to really distinguish him from other monks. That's also in the suttas, yeah? The King Adadasattu comes to the Sangha. 1,200 monks are sitting there, and he asks, which one is the Buddha? He couldn't tell the difference because they all looked basically the same. And so you go into the forest, you see this person sitting there very peacefully. And you kind of heard some good words about this person. Yeah, this is a very special person. So you feel a bit kind of nervous perhaps. You can imagine approaching the Buddha, pretty kind of nerve-wracking. Yeah, this is kind of the greatest spiritual master in kind of human history. That's what you have heard, that's what you've been told. So you feel a bit sort of, but of course, once you understand what the Buddha is, you know that there is nothing to fear. The Buddha has your best interest at heart. The Buddha lives this life out of compassion for beings. So if you are sincere in your spiritual search, if you really want to find out the truth about reality, there's nothing really to fear about the Buddha. And then as you approach the Buddha, you start to relax because you understand this is a very ordinary, this is a person with a lot of kindness, a lot of patience, who only wants the very best for you. So you sit down in the presence of the Buddha, and Buddha doesn't say anything. And then maybe after a while you kind of build up courage to ask a question. And then the Buddha will reply to you in a very calm and a very even, a very compassionate way. And often the Buddha will give, what kind of answer will the Buddha give? What do you think? How does the Buddha speak? And the way the Buddha speaks is a very simple way. Yeah, he will tell you very simple things. Why is that? Because the Buddha is the teacher of everyone. He will teach in a way where we can actually understand what is going on. This is not a competition in being some kind of intellectual superstar abusing fancy words or anything like that. It's about getting a message across. And because the Buddha taught all levels in society, he will get the message across in a way that was understandable for everyone. So sometimes when we translate the suttas, we should keep that in mind. We should keep in mind that they should be translated in a way we use ordinary language, not some highfalutin language that is very hard for people to understand. And then his message will get across. And he will say something simple about being virtuous, about being kind, the very basics of the path. Yeah, and if he felt that you were kind of ready to do meditation practice, he might teach you about anapanasati or something like that. Yeah, and that would be kind of your vision of the Buddha, this simple man in the forest, very simple, very compassionate, very profound. And only after a while, after speaking with him for a while, you start to understand the profundity and wisdom that lies behind that simple surface. Yeah, so this is like the Buddha, it's like a human being. It is not something very unique or very special. And yet at the same time, it is also very special, because at the same time, this person sitting there has an insight, an understanding of reality that is also extraordinarily profound at the same time. So it's like this strange duality, the duality of ordinariness and extraordinariness coming together in a person. And that is really what the Buddha is. And as I was saying yesterday, you know, if we're going to put anyone on a pedestal, one of the great things about coming here and bowing down to the Buddha statue is that you're bowing down to this person with these remarkable qualities. The person who has found this path, understood reality, who has the ability to teach us where real happiness lies, who has developed himself to the highest degree of compassion and metta and wisdom. Yeah, and we know, and the Buddha tells us, that we too have that potential inside of us. So what we are bowing down to is things that are really worthy of praise in the world, things that lead to happiness, things that lead to goodness, things that are really worthy of respect. Usually we bow down to all the useless stuff. These are things really worthy of bowing down to. That is why we bow down to the Buddha statue. We don't bow down to the Buddha statue because we worship a piece of metal. That's not the point. What you bow down to is these qualities that are there potentially in all of us. And then we are respecting something very beautiful. And then the idea of bowing down actually is a very beautiful thing. It's understanding that we only have a limited understanding of reality of ourselves. And there are things in the world that are worthy of respect, worthy of bowing down to. Because once you start bowing down to them, you are being humble to a certain extent with your own understanding. And that helps you in developing those qualities yourself in the future. So there you are, just some very simple ideas about the Buddha, and but actually very profound and very beautiful. And it's important that we kind of put the Buddha on the right kind of pedestal, as I like to say, not put the Buddha on the God pedestal. So many Buddhists these days think of the Buddha as a kind of God. Yeah, it's very common around the Buddhist world. And people pray to the Buddha pretty much like people pray to a creator God. It's, you know, you find very similar kind of ideas. I think this is a very basic disposition in human beings, that we like this idea of praying to something greater than us that can help us. But that's not really how the Buddha works. It's not really like that. The Buddha is different. The Buddha is the one who points the way. And we need to put him on the right kind of pedestal and respect him in the right way. And then it actually helps us in our practice. Okay. So that is the very first part, the qualities of the Buddha. And then, of course, because the Buddha has these qualities, because he has realized all of these things for himself, then he starts teaching. That is the next part here, about the qualities of the Buddha. So, having realized by his own insight or direct knowledge this world with its devas, Mara, and Brahma, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, he makes it known to others. He teaches a Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and right phrasing here. He reveals a spiritual life that is perfectly complete and pure. Now it is good to see such arahants. So here, after you have realized the whole world, yeah, here, this is like a summary of what we've been talking about with its devas and Mara and Brahma. These are like the main gods of India at that time. So basically he's saying that, well, actually the Buddha has seen all of this. He understands all of these gods and all of that. Yeah, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, what does it mean to having realized this population with its ascetic and Brahmins? And what it means is that Buddha has investigated all the philosophies and all the spiritual doctrines and all the teachings that are available at that time. He has understood all of that, and he has seen that in context to his own realization, understanding how it all fits in, which ones are true, which ones are partially true, which ones are false, etc. All of that has kind of, he has absorbed that. Some of the suttas, you will find this, you will find the Buddha actually kind of criticizes the teachings of others, pointing out when they are dangerous, for example, when they lead you down the wrong path and they lead you to living a bad life and all of these kind of things. So this is what it means to realize this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, the understanding of which philosophies actually lead you in the right way and which ones don't. It's devas and humans, and he makes it known to others. Yeah, when you make the Dhamma known to others, that is when the Dhamma arises in the world. You get the teaching. First of all, you get the Buddha, then the Dhamma arises as a consequence of the Buddha. The Dhamma arises as a consequence of that realization. And then you teach this beautiful Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Yeah, remember that. It's supposed to be good in the beginning. I don't know where you're at, whether you are in the middle or the end or the beginning, but most people tend to be in the beginning. Yeah, that's usually the way things are. It's supposed to be good in the beginning. It means that you should ideally enjoy the spiritual life pretty much right away. It should have a positive impact on you. Don't think that if spiritual life is masses of suffering, then it will be good in the end. That's not really how Buddhism works. Yeah, going through all the difficulties, having a really hard time, it will lead to something positive in the end. It's supposed to have a positive impact on you pretty much straight away. As you know, the beginning of the path is about morality and kindness. And you should be able to see how being kind actually enhances your quality of life. Life becomes better because of that. As you move on to the meditation practice, that too should have a positive experience in your life. It's more like the middle of the path when we start to have more profound experiences of meditation and all that. You should be able to enjoy your meditation. So make it enjoyable. Yeah, don't do what so many Buddhists do and make meditation into some kind of unbearable experience where you have to kind of fight and struggle and try to watch all the pain in the body and all these kind of things. Make it an enjoyable part of the path. This is essentially the message here, part of the message. And if you're not enjoying it, ask yourself why. What can I change? How can I do this thing differently? Maybe I should just go and have a cup of tea. Yeah? Please go and have a cup of tea. Yeah? Isn't that great? Such a wonderful thing. You go and have a cup of tea, you go out and have a look in the forest, you do whatever, until you start enjoying your meditation again. You come back in here afterwards, you have relaxed, you feel at ease, you enjoy it again. Don't push yourself too hard. Find the right balance. Good in the middle. And of course, good in the end, at the end of the path, when you get the true insights. That's where the real goodness happens on this path, and where things really start to come together, and you find the real meaning and the real purpose of these things. With the right meaning and right phrasing, the right meaning is like having a real goal, a real purpose, the highest happiness, the ending of all suffering, yeah? Finding the meaning of life. This is like the right meaning, not some kind of temporary or, you know, middling meaning, but the real profound meaning. Yeah? The right phrasing. The idea that when the Buddha speaks, he puts a lot of care into how he teaches the Dhamma. It is not random. Everything is systematic. Everything is done in the right kind of way. Every word has a meaning. We saw this before in the Pasadika Sutta, the sutta which is called the Delightful Discourse, about how the Dhamma is just right, nothing superfluous, nothing missing. The phrasing itself is important. He reveals a spiritual life that is perfectly complete and pure. Paripunna, parisuddhi, parisuddha is the other words he used for this. Paripunna means complete. There is nothing missing. You don't need anything else. You don't need to go outside. Everything you need, all the inspiration, all the information, all the entire gradual path is there. This is all you require to actually go from the very beginning all the way to awakening. Parisuddha, perfectly pure. In other words, all the aspects of morality are included in this. If you follow this fully here, full purity will arise as a consequence. It is a complete path. Don't have to go anywhere else. Spiritual life, the Brahmacharya, and this is what this all what this is all about. Now it is good to see such arahants. That is no understatement. That is certainly really good to see such arahants. This is what I mean by the suttas. They're kind of understated, It is good to see such arahants. It sounds kind of very, very ordinary, but actually it is really good to see such arahants, Because without seeing such arahants, there's no beginning of the path. The very path begins with that. This is the Kalyanamitta. This is the Buddha. This is getting right view. This is getting started, getting out of delusion from the very beginning. It is the essence of the holy life is to see, in many ways, is to see such arahants and see such Buddhas to get us going on the path, get us started. So how come that these Kalamas know that the Buddha is an arahant? They say, now it is good to see such arahants. Well, you could say that it is because of the reputation he has, that might be a reason. But the Kalamas, they don't. How can they possibly know that? And the answer to this is that the word arahant in India in those days just meant someone who was spiritually perfected. It meant someone who had practiced some kind of spiritual... Everybody was potential arahants. It didn't actually mean arahant in a Buddhist way. It just meant someone who had practiced the spiritual path in a good way. So people were calling all kind of people arahants, not just the Buddha. So it was just a general terminology here. And this is one of the things that you see in the suttas, the Buddha using the general terminology of the day, and then you're starting to use it in a new way, a way that applies to Buddhism specifically. Anyway, we'll see more of this later on as we go through this. So that is just the introduction. Now the Kalamas, they want to go and see the Buddha. Then the Kalamas of Kesaputta approached the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down to one side. Some exchanged greetings with him. And when they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, they sat down to one side. Some reverentially saluted him and sat down to one side. Some pronounced their name and clan and sat down to one side. Some kept silent and sat down to one side. And sitting to one side, the Kalamas said this to the Blessed One. So before I go on to what they said, I just thought it might be useful to very briefly just see this interesting little paragraph, about what all these people, what they do, how they act when they come to see the Buddha. What is the point of all this? Why is this in there? What is actually going on? And of course, what is going on is that people, just like nowadays, had different degrees of respect for a spiritual guru or a spiritual teacher. Some people may have been already semi-Buddhist and heard about the Buddha before, were very impressed. Some were much more skeptical. So you had all kinds of people coming to see the Buddha, all with different degrees of insight and understanding and faith and confidence and wisdom and all of this. And this is one of those beautiful things about India in those days. It was a very spiritually pluralistic society, all kind of various spiritual teachings, people wandering around, giving teachings here and there, and it's kind of a big melting pot of spiritual teachings. Even more so, perhaps, than in the present day. And people were very open-minded. They would listen to the different teachings, and then they would make up their minds and perhaps start to follow one teacher as a consequence. It's a very interesting kind of society. Most of human history is not quite as tolerant as that. India in those days was very, very tolerant and open society. So when they meet a spiritual teacher, they would then act in accordance with their faith. And this is a good example for how we can act also in the present day. So if you come to the Janagaur Retreat Center or Dhammaloka Center, whatever, to listen to a Dhamma talk, you are also allowed to kind of choose your approach when you go there. Are you already a committed disciple of the Buddha? Well, then it's perhaps natural that you come in and you bow down. Once you get used to the idea of bowing down, it's actually a very beautiful thing to do. It's actually very nice to bow down. It feels right. It feels like you are, you know, worshipping something really worthy of, maybe not worshipping, but respecting something really worthy of respect. And you say that, well, I also aspire to those qualities. And if you aspire to something, it's good to be a bit humble. And that humility you show, in a sense, by bowing down to something that is slightly superior to yourself, but that you actually are, that you actually aspire for. It's a very beautiful act to bow down to something superior. But if you don't feel like that because you haven't got that confidence yet, you don't have to bow down. If you come here, please don't feel any pressure to kind of do what everyone else does or what some other people do. Do what feels right to you. If you do it because you feel pressure to do it, it can often backfire. So just sit down on your seat, listen to the Dhamma talks, take it in. If you don't even like the Dhamma talks, you don't even have to be here. Do what you like, do what you enjoy, allow it to come naturally. And then one day it might come naturally for you to also to bow down. Or it may not come naturally, which also is fine. So it shows us that also in our day, it is perfectly acceptable that we have different attitudes to the Dhamma. As we move towards this, we either become stronger in our faith and confidence, or it becomes weaker and maybe we go in a different direction. Either one is okay. So keep that in mind. Please don't allow yourself to be, no need to be pressured by other people. Do what comes naturally to you. That is usually the best policy with these kind of things. So now we come to what actually happened with the Kalamas and the Buddha. And this is what they say, the Kalamas said to the Blessed One. Bhante, there are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but they disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. We are perplexed and in doubt, Bhante, as to which of these good ascetics speak the truth and which speak falsehood. So you have all these mutually contradictory teachings, and they all kind of blame the others and they all kind of praise their own teachings. So what are we going to do? And the Buddha replies, it is fitting for you to be perplexed, Kalamas. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Come, Kalamas, and this is the kind of the famous line in this particular sutta. Come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of scriptures, by logical reasoning, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned reflection or cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our teacher. But when, Kalamas, you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. So this is this very famous passage because it kind of what it does, it brings the onus back on us to be to decide what teachings are really important. It tells us we have to reflect, we have to be careful with our own spiritual life. We have to take responsibility with our lives. But a very important thing to remember about this passage is that these Kalamas, they are confused. Yeah, they don't really have a teacher yet. They are not Buddhist. They're trying to kind of find their way in the spiritual supermarket of India at that time. They didn't really have supermarkets in those days, but you know what I mean? The vast kind of broad range of spiritual teachings. They were trying to find the way, fumbling away in the darkness. So it is specific and advice that is used for people who are still at the early stages of the spiritual search, trying to find a way. If you are a committed Buddhist, then of course your attitude will be slightly different. And I will talk about that later on, what happens in those cases. But this is mostly for people who are starting out, yeah, trying to find a way, trying to find where we should place our faith and confidence. So the first thing the Buddha says, it is fitting to be in doubt. Yeah, if you hear all of these kind of teachings, doubt is okay. And this is already, I think, a very important statement, that if things are doubtful, it is okay to have doubt about things. In Buddhism, we don't say that, you know, if you have doubt about things, you should kind of have certainty, you should kind of just place your faith there, even though you have doubts, even though it doesn't make any sense. Please have faith in these things. That is not the Buddhist attitude. Yeah, if things are doubtful, if it doesn't make any sense, then don't just have blind faith in those things. Question those things. Try to figure out whether it's true or not. The Buddhist idea is not about blind faith. It is about reasonable faith, faith that is supported by the evidence. Ideally, the best kind of evidence is like the empirical evidence, the scientific evidence, whereby you see things with clarity for yourself to be true, and then you draw conclusions from that. Buddhism is almost, in that sense, it is has a scientific nature to it, in the sense that it is about trying to see things clearly, getting empirical evidence, not just following things for the sake of following things. So if you have doubts, it's okay to have doubts. Yeah, sometimes you hear in Buddhist circles that this person is an arahant, so you know, don't have any doubts about this person, because if you have doubts about this person, you will make bad karma. It's actually the other way around. Yeah, if there is someone who does strange things and they don't really deserve to be thought of as an arahant, you should have doubt about that. Not to have doubt about it, that is what is silly here. And because there's too often in our society, we tend to praise the people not really worthy of praise. And then we dispraise those who are worthy of praise. Don't be afraid of when you see things that don't seem right. Don't be afraid to have doubt. It is important. It's actually right to have doubt in those cases. And it's certainly not bad karma. It's actually much better karma to have doubt than to pretend that everything is okay when in fact it isn't. And then we come to this series of things that the Buddha says we should not use. Yeah, especially when we start out. We should not go by these various measures and take them as absolute truth. Rather, we should actually think for ourselves. And what are these things? Let us quickly just go over these things that people used to decide what is what is an appropriate religion or not. First of thing, you have the oral tradition. And the oral tradition is very much like in those days would have been the Vedas, the existing traditions that were already in India, which would have been largely the Brahmanical tradition, what the precursor to modern-day Hinduism, the Brahmanical tradition, the ancient Vedas that existed already at that time. They had been passed down through centuries already, so they were already an established oral tradition. So the Buddha is saying, well, don't go by that, yeah? It is uncertain. Just because there's an old ancient tradition, why does that make it true? Just because it is a tradition? You don't know, yeah, maybe the tradition is right, maybe not, but you can't be sure about that, so leave that aside. Lineage of teaching, parampara, yeah, one teacher after another, and this also existed in India in those days. Things like Jainism seems to have existed before Buddhism, so you had all these other religions as well, which had already been passed down from generation to generation. Yeah, there may not have been an oral tradition as such, but a teaching that had been more informally passed down, but from teacher to teacher. That too is uncertain. Just because something has been passed down doesn't necessarily make it true. Then you have hearsay. Hearsay here seems to mean something like a general consensus in society, agreed kind of wisdom among people, yeah? Sometimes like common sense, perhaps you might call it. Common sense, sometimes it is sensible, sometimes common sense is not sensible, yeah? So you just don't know whether common sense is right or not. It is unreliable, uncertain. Again, you have to think for yourself. Then we have here the collection of scriptures or scriptural authority is another way of thinking of that. In those days, that would have been an oral scriptures. So just because someone has some fancy scriptures and ancient scriptures, again, that is again not really a grounds for making a decision about things. Yeah, very easy for people to be convinced by things just because they are ancient and old, just because everyone else thinks like this. Yeah, well, the whole world kind of has this idea, so we too should have the same idea. If everyone thinks like that, surely it must be correct. Yeah, if the whole world says that this religion is right, surely that religion must have something to it. But actually, it's often the other way around, isn't it? Because very often, where the majority tends to go, the majority usually isn't right. Usually it takes someone special to see the truth, someone to break through the delusion of the majority. So just because the majority has gone somewhere, just because everyone else has faith in this particular teacher, or whatever it is, doesn't mean that that is the right place to be. It could be, but often it is not. So again, don't be afraid of kind of going our own ways, looking at things differently. Being a bit rebellious is very important in this world. A sheep is never really going to find the happiness. You're just going to become another sheep. And that is kind of part of the problem there. So these are all authority based on tradition, yeah, based on past things that have been handed down. Then we come to the next kind of reasons for believing in a particular religion, and these are all logical reasons. So the first one is logical reasoning. It's just logic, basically. Yeah, just you kind of you add 2 + 2. Okay, 2 + 2 = 4. Okay, so this must be true. Something like that. Inferential reasoning. Inference means that you have certain basic ideas, and then based on those basic ideas, you then kind of come to a conclusion about something. Maybe you have some evidence from the world and you add that together with some other things and you infer, you draw conclusions based on whatever evidence is available to you. It's a kind of logic in a sense too. Reasoned cogitation, reasoned reflection. You reflect on things, yeah, and you kind of, after reflecting on things, you come to conclusion again. And by acceptance of a view after pondering on it, it's like you reflect on things and you are given a view by somebody and eventually you accept that view because you reflect on it long enough. So all of these things are basically come down to a kind of logic, a kind of reflection. And based on that reflection, based on that logic, you then come to a conclusion. Yeah. So what is the problem with this? Isn't logic okay? What's wrong with logic? And the point here is that in matters that are spiritual, of course, in mathematics, logic is perfectly okay, because in mathematics, you have certain axioms, and you know those axioms, and you kind of, based on that, you then develop all these mathematical theorems or whatever it is. But in a spiritual context, the logic all depends on your assumptions. What are your assumptions? And if your assumptions are wrong, if your axioms at the root of this are wrong, then of course the logic is going to be skewed as well. The logic is only as good as your basic assumptions are. And the problem from a Buddhist point of view is that our basic assumptions tend to be wrong. That's what delusion is all about. If you start off deluded, it means that your basic assumptions are wrong. So the whole kind of logical structure that you build up, the whole philosophy that you build up, is going to be standing lacking a foundation. Or this is going to be a wrong foundation. It's going to collapse at any time. And the whole thing turns out just to be a pie in the sky. There's nothing there to it. It is all just completely wobbly. It's a house of cards or whatever. There's nothing there. So logic is useful, but it's only useful insofar as your assumptions are correct. So the Buddha does use logic. He does use inference in the suttas. But of course, the point is that the Buddha does that based on his own empirical understanding of reality. Once you have looked at reality, you have seen reality empirically through your inside, so you have a proper foundation for that, then logical reasoning is perfectly okay. Then some of these other things are perfectly okay as well. The collection of scriptures, yeah? If the collection of scriptures, like the Tripitaka or whatever, if it is based on proper insight, then again, there is no issue there, there's no problem. So these things are not always wrong, but the point is that they're not always right. And that is really the point here. Then we have the last two. The last two are about the competence of the speaker, yeah, the appearance of competence, if you like, or because you think the ascetic is our guru. Guru, the word guru in Pali, it's garu, and the word garu means like respect, yeah? So it means the ascetic is respected by us, or the ascetic is our respected teacher. Guru also means teacher. I'm not sure if the idea is really ideal to leave the word guru, because the word guru sometimes can have a bit of a pejorative meaning in the present day. Yeah, guru is like some kind of, sometimes it means like a dodgy spiritual teacher. Sometimes it means like an expert. Yeah, it can mean various things. But here it really means like a respected teacher. That's what it means in this particular context. So again, just because someone is very impressive, yeah, they may be very charismatic, they may be a good speaker, or whatever else, it doesn't necessarily mean very much to the profundity of the teachings, whether those teachings really are good or not. So be careful not to be led astray by charismatic teachers. There are too many people in the world who get led astray by that. Yeah, so charisma in itself is not wrong, but it is wrong if it leads you astray. Yeah, and that is where the problem is. So don't allow these things to lead you astray. Otherwise, you may end up with all kind of problems on the spiritual path. There's too much of this thing going on in the world. People are often too naive. Yeah. So trust yourself. Trust your judgment. Don't be too naive. Find that middle way, the balance. Try to be wise to what is going on. So all of these things are uncertain, yeah? This is what the Buddha says, don't go by these things purely on their own, because these things are uncertain. They're not necessarily wrong, but the point is that they're not necessarily right, and that is really the point here, especially when you start out. So what should we do then? And what the Buddha says next is really the important point here. When you start out, you should investigate whether these things are sensible or not, whether they fit with your experience. Yeah? In the end, we are responsible for our own spiritual life. You have to make sure that you are on the right track. Don't give away that responsibility blindly to someone else. If you do, you're putting yourself in danger. So reflect on these things. And this is then why the Buddha says what he does here. When you know for yourself, these things are wholesome. Yeah, wholesome is like skillful in Buddhism. These things are healthy, if you like. Unwholesome here. These things are blameworthy. These things are criticized by the wise, or if you like, by sensible people. These things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to harm and suffering. Then you should abandon them. Yeah, so you look at these things. Well, what do I think? Are these things good or bad? If a spiritual teacher says, yeah, you know, whether you kill or steal doesn't matter. Have you ever met a spiritual teacher like that? Not so many these days, yeah, but in ancient India, you actually had spiritual teachers like that. That's what they said. Yeah, if you go and slaughter all these beings and you kind of do all bad, doesn't make any difference, yeah? If you are really kind and generous, doesn't make any difference. Whatever you do, all beings kind of just fare on according to fate anyway, so it doesn't matter what you do. So if you kind of accept that simply because, you know, you find the teacher impressive or not, and you don't ask yourself whether that fits with your own personal experience, that's where you can go really badly wrong. So you ask yourself whether it is sensible or not. Are these things blameworthy? Are they censured by the wise? Interesting. What does it mean, the wise here? Isn't that precisely these spiritual people we're talking about? Well, not necessarily, because How do we decide whether someone is wise or someone is sensible? And the way, according to the suttas, how you decide whether someone is wise is that you hang out with them for a long time. You are around them. You watch their conduct. You have awareness yourself. You have a discussion with them. And it takes a long time to know whether somebody is wise. If somebody just passes through your village or through your town and they have a good reputation and they talk in a fancy way and they are charismatic, that is not enough to decide whether someone is wise or not. You have to listen to them for a long time. So the people who are wise here are people you already know. Yeah, you listen to them. You listen to the elders in the community. Those people you know are sensible. And that is how, this is what is meant by wise here, not just anyone who you have met quite recently. And you know that these things lead to should not lead to harm and suffering. If they do, then it is problematic. Yeah, so a very commonsensical idea of how to start out. And then the Buddha goes into more detail, and he says, "What do you think, Kalamas, when greed arises in a person? Is it for their welfare or for their harm? For their harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a greedy person, overcome by greed, with mind obsessed by it, destroys life, takes what is not given, transgresses with another person's wife or husband, speaks falsehood, and they encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to their harm and suffering for a long time?" Yes, Bhante. So here the Buddha is pointing out that if you are greedy, yeah, you can, if you really are on a spiritual path, you probably will restrain it. But if you're not on any spiritual path, then greed will tend to lead you to do immoral actions. Yeah, so this is basically what he's pointing out here. And that's very obvious. Yeah, I think most people can see that in themselves, that this can happen sometimes. Unless something restrains you, it is kind of natural that this will happen. And one of the interesting things here, which is part of Buddhist morality, he says that you encourage others to do likewise. Yeah, this is one of the bad things in Buddhism, to encourage others to do bad deeds. One of the aspects of morality in Buddhism is to actually encourage others to live well and to live the life properly. Yeah, this is part of morality. You encourage others. It actually, one of the great things about teaching the Dhamma is that you also get encouraged when you teach Dhamma. Yeah, you encourage others, you also get encouraged. They get encouraged. It kind of boosts everyone as a consequence. What do you think, Kalamas, when ill will arises in a person? Is it for their welfare or for their harm? For their harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a person who is full of hate, overcome by hate, with mind obsessed by it, again, does all of these bad things. Those bad things are essentially the five precepts. Yeah, apart from alcohol, you have the five precepts there, essentially. And they encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to their harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, Bhante. What do you think, Kalamas, when delusion or confusion arises in a person? Is it for their welfare or for their harm? For their harm, Bhante. Kalamas, a person who is confused or deluded, overcome by delusion, with mind obsessed by it, again, they transgress the five precepts and encourage others to do likewise. Will that be for their harm and suffering for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So there you have the three unwholesome roots. Yeah, these are the basic kind of driving forces in human beings that make us bad things. And these are the roots that tell us whether we are making bad karma or not. So if you want to know about karma in Buddhism, it is one of those very interesting topics to talk about karma. What is good karma and what is bad karma? And people very often ask the question, I've done this act, is it good karma or bad karma? Well, actually, very often, you cannot tell from the act itself whether it's good karma or not. You have to go deeper down. You have to ask about the motivation that drives you. Then you know whether something is bad karma or not. So these are the three things that decide whether an action is bad or not. Is it done by a desire, ill will, or confusion, delusion. If it is, then it is bad karma. Yeah, this is really the profundity of Buddhist morality. You have always to come back to the motivation that drives people. This is how you decide these things. And this is made more plain in other suttas, but it's also implied here. Then the Buddha says, what do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Unwholesome, Bhante. In other words, unhealthy. Yeah, they are unskillful. They lead in the wrong direction. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameworthy, Bhante. Censured or praised by the wise? Censured by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to harm and suffering or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things lead to harm and suffering, so we take it. And that is really the critical problem with wrong view. If you really have wrong view, it means that you act accordingly. And when you act accordingly, you end up doing all sorts of bad things. Thus, Kalamas, when we said, come, Kalamas, do not go by oral tradition and all of these other things, only when you know for yourself these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by sensible people, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. It is because of this that this was said. Okay, so that is the negative side of the equation. And of course, this has consequences, because once you understand how to reflect on these things properly, you also have the basis for actually what teachings are acceptable and which are not. Yeah, so you are kind of giving yourself the basis here for deciding among the various teachers. And now comes the positive side of the equation. What do you think, Kalamas, when non-greed arises in a person? Is it for their welfare or for their harm? For their welfare, Bhante. Kalamas, a person without greed, not overcome by greed or desire, their mind not obsessed by it, does not destroy life, does not take what is given, does not transgress with another's wife or speak falsehood, nor do they encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. So when your mind is pure, yeah, when your mind is clear, when you know what is going on, you don't actually transgress these five precepts at all. And you, for that reason, you don't create all these bad, negative things. How do you know that these things are bad? Well, you know, because when you do this thing, they lead to all kinds of problems. You feel bad about yourself. Other people feel bad about it. It creates conflicts in society. But also, one of the interesting things about things like greed and ill will, if you compare the mind which is greedy, if you compare the mind with ill will to the mind which is without these things, it's actually not very hard to see that the mind state without these things is far more desirable than the mind state which has these defilements. What does it feel to be greedy? It feels kind of confined. It feels self-centered. It feels like you've kind of gone into your own little world. But if you don't have greed, if you are generous, if you are open-handed, if you are someone who is compassionate and care for other beings, it's as if your mind expands out. It is a far more beautiful mind state not to be greedy than to have desires and greed. And the same for ill will. So notice that. Notice the confinement in greed. Notice the limitedness. Notice how your mind is narrowed down into this kind of self-concern. Self-concern is actually a painful and unpleasant condition to be in. But the concern for everyone, the kind of creation of wanting to help others, is actually a very beautiful mind state. It expands you out, and you feel free from a limiting and a restricting aspect quality inside of you. What do you think, Kalamas, when non-hatred or non-ill will arises in a person? Is it for their welfare or for their harm? For their welfare, Bhante. Kalamas, a person who is without ill will, not overcome by ill will, their mind not obsessed by it, does not destroy life, does not breach the five precepts, nor do they encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. What do you think, Kalamas, when non-delusion or confusion arises in a person? Is it for their welfare or for their harm? For their welfare, Bhante. Kalamas, a person who is not unconfused, who has a clear mind, not overcome by delusion, the mind not obsessed by it, does not breach the five precepts, nor do they encourage others to do likewise. Will that lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time? Yes, Bhante. What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome? Wholesome, Bhante. Blameworthy or blameless? Blameless, Bhante. Censured, in other words, criticized or praised by the wise. Praised by the wise, Bhante. Accepted and undertaken, do they lead to welfare and happiness or not? Or how do you take it? Accepted and undertaken, these things lead to welfare and happiness. So we take it. Thus, Kalamas, when we said, come, Kalamas, do not go by all of these various oral traditions and logic, etc. But when you know for yourself, these things are wholesome, these things are blameless, these things are praised by the wise, these things, if accepted and undertaken, lead to welfare and happiness, then you should live in accordance with them. It is because of this that this was said. So that is the Buddha's advice to the Kalamas, yeah? The idea that we use our own common sense as far as we have common sense. In the end, we have to rely on ourselves to some extent. It's impossible to really rely on others, because even if you rely on others, you have to choose which other people to rely on. It always comes back to us. We have to take responsibility for our own spiritual life. This is really what the Buddha says here. But that is at the beginning. Yeah. After a while, if you have been around the Buddhist teachings for a long time, you have gained faith in these teachings, you have seen some of this working in your own life through your meditation practice, through your acting of kindness and generosity or whatever it is, as you develop an understanding of these teachings in a deeper way, there comes a point where it becomes more natural to take on board some of the things that the Buddha says. Yeah. So if the Buddha says that there is rebirth, and you have gained a lot of confidence in how the Buddha speaks, it makes sense at some point to say, okay, well, if that's what the Buddha says, I will at least, provisionally at least, I will take on board the idea of rebirth. Yeah, I will assume that maybe there's something to it because the Buddha says so. Again, you don't kind of leave all skepticism aside. If it doesn't feel natural for you, you don't actually just take it on board as an absolute truth, but at least you allow for the possibility that it is true because the Buddha says so. So it is like a gradual thing, yeah? You gradually move into the Buddha's teachings. You try to grow with these teachings. You are reasonable about them. And as you are reasonable about them and as you grow with them, it is natural that that faith and confidence grows. And then you become more open to those things that maybe you found initially to be more difficult to accept. Especially things like rebirth, because really the idea of rebirth is very fundamental to the whole idea that Buddhism is about. So it's actually important to have some, at least after a while, to have some feeling about that. So this is the right approach. Yeah, this is then you start to deal with these teachings in the right way. And then the Buddha says towards the very end here, this is also quite interesting, once he has given all these teachings, he says, then Kalamas, that noble disciple, in other words, the disciples who act according to, in all these positive ways, who is thus devoid of desire, devoid of ill will, unconfused, with full awareness or clear comprehension, if you like, who is mindful, then what do? They dwell with one quarter, with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And then you have the four Brahma Viharas, yeah? Based on that more basic morality, you then develop the Brahma Viharas, the Metta, the Karuna, the Mudita, and the Upeka as a consequence. The loving kindness, the compassion, sympathetic joy, and then the equanimity as the last one. And then comes the interesting part. At the very end of that, after all of this, and I should have left that in there. I'm not sure why I took it out. I probably didn't read it carefully enough. But after that, the Buddha then says to the Kalamas, he says to them, well, if there is such a thing as a rebirth, yeah, the Kalamas are confused of what is true or not, but the Buddha said, well, if, let's say, that there is such a thing as rebirth, then if you have lived well, if you have done all the right things, well, then rebirth is likely to be less problematic because you have developed something positive in this life, and it's more likely you will take that positivity with you into the future. Yeah, it's like a natural law that when the mind is well developed, you take that with you into the future. This was a natural understanding, presumably, at that time. So there's less reason to be worried about a future life. Yeah, you see, the people who are most scared of the future life are the people who have developed their mind less. The more developed your mind is, if you feel very pure inside, it is very hard to be scared about death even. Death doesn't really matter so much anymore. You have the feeling inside of you that you are safe. It's almost like a natural feeling that comes through having developed these things in the right way. And then the Buddha said, well, if there is no rebirth, well, if you have developed all these things, you'll be very happy and content in the present life because you will have abandoned all those things that make the present life miserable and negative. So either way, this is like a safety in the future. And this is one of those things that the Buddha brings in this sutta. He also brings it in other suttas like the Appanaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya number 60, where he says that you cannot go wrong by developing the spiritual path. If it doesn't bring benefits in this life, or if it doesn't bring benefit in the future life, at the very least, it will be very beneficial in this life. But of course, from a Buddhist point of view, it is beneficial, both greatly beneficial in this life, also in future life, and also to attain the highest happiness on the path. So, there you are. That is the famous Kalama Sutta, and this is the kind of the background for right view. This is how we kind of begin to develop right view. We are now dealing with the very first factor on the Noble Eightfold Path, and this is how kind of the entrance point to right view. We start off with going with our own experience. We start off by relying on our own ability to judge what is right and what is wrong. And from there, right view starts to develop. So this is the very beginning of right view. And we'll then see later on this afternoon how this develops when gradually we move on to the full right view of the Buddhist path. That's all for now, and we'll see you back again this afternoon at 3 o'clock.